Hello. If everyone could please be seated so we can
get
started.
All right, we're going to get started here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator for our second session, Machine Readable Rights, is Courtney Harding. Take it away, Courtney.
All right. Yay. All right. Well, thank you so much, and thanks, everyone, for being here on this unconscionably hot day, schlepping all the way over here. I'm Courtney Harding. I am a writer and consultant. Right now I'm working on a cryptocurrency platform and a virtual reality company. So if you have questions about either of those things, please feel free to chat with me. I'm also a journalist. I write for Qpoint and Hypebot, among other outlets. So if you have anything that pertains to that, please let me know. We're here to talk about machine-readable rights, but I think what we're actually here to talk about is why we need to fix the data that can then be read by these machines. Because we're in a situation right now where we are trying to build a building, but the foundation is completely unstable. So before we can even talk about what platforms we're going to use, what machines we're going to use, and how we're going to build that technology, we need to back up and talk about how do we fix the data, because I think we can all agree that the data right now is a disaster. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to have the panelists introduce themselves very quickly, and then we're going to dive right in, and we're going to see if we can tackle this data problem, and then hopefully come up with some solutions. So if the panelists just want to get started.
Hi, I'm Henrik DeGior. I'm a chief consultant for another damn consultancy. I work for with clients about digital asset management, rights management, and metadata management. So metadata and rights obviously usually go hand in hand to one degree or another, and look forward to speaking about that.
Hi, I'm Carl Flirsch. I'm leading development of Ujo Music, which is a consensus startup, and we are building a open music rights platform, and based on using blockchain technologies, especially Ethereum.
Hey, I'm Bill Wilson. I am VP of Digital Strategy for the Music Business Association. I am also a co-founder of Dot Blockchain Music with Benji Rogers.
David Hughes, I'm CTO at the Recording Industry Association of America. Previous to that, I was at Sony Music for many years, and been working on this stuff for about 21 years now, so I'm hoping that we're going to get to a solution today.
Yes, in this hour. We're all going to walk out of here millionaires.
And I am Luis Bonilla. I'm the senior director of distribution services at Sound Exchange, and I pretty much oversee all royalty processing, and I own our distribution engine and our data warehouse.
Great. So as you can tell, we have a really fantastic panel with a great depth of knowledge and experience. So let's dive right in. I wanted to start with an anecdote that I think really exemplifies some of the problems with music metadata. And I know that as we were prepping for the panel, some other folks on this panel had similar stories. So I was meeting with a label last year that is I won't name them, but they are a venerable, well-known, independent label. Big catalog, great, you've heard of them. I was chatting with them, and I was at that point working on a platform that was going to do some smart contract processing. And I said, this platform's really great. You just upload all your contracts, and we take care of the rest. And the person I met with kind of laughed at me, and she said, yeah, we don't have contracts with a lot of our bands. Because from the founding of the label until maybe the early 2000s, everything was a handshake deal. They were all friends. And this is a label that, sold millions of copies of these albums, and there's no data, there's not even a contract. And that's not uncommon in this business, and that's a huge challenge that we have to start dealing with. So the first question I wanted to sort of throw out to the panel and have them chat a little bit about was, how do we start tackling this problem of data that doesn't even exist, let alone data that is a complete mess? So the first question I want to ask the panel is, where do we go when this is our reality? And people can just jump in as they want.
With respect to contract data, are you talking about, because as a former / current owner of an indie label catalog that I ran, there are things that I have not normalized into a spreadsheet. I do have contracts with all of my bands dating back to the late 80s. But I know that, for example, even when you go and look at things like photographs at labels, there's a large swath, if not, you know, a daunting amount of visual assets that could be used, but because nobody knows the usage rights attached to them, because the contracts are all buyouts or promotional use only or things like that, and they're sitting, you know, in stacks, and nobody knows how to use this because the rights are not tethered to the asset. I think that most major labels probably have a much better knowledge of their catalog and their data. And it's up to the independents who want to get paid to kind of shore that up and, you know, even create, and for what they don't have, to be able to, you know, put down what they remember of the handshake, at least as a starting point, you know, the first cell in the chain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the sort of thing that I was trying to exemplify with that story was, you know, we're in a place where the data is all over the place and a mess, and the biggest challenge is there doesn't seem to be an economic incentive for labels to really take action to fix this. So how do we incentivize labels, artists, rights holders, whomever, to take this seriously? Because I think if you look at current data, it's in reasonably good shape. If you look at high-selling catalog data, it's in reasonably good shape. None of it's perfect. It's decent. But when you're talking about an album that sold 2,000 copies in 1973 and the artist quit being an artist and went to law school, you know, who's running that show? Like, where's the data on that?
Yeah, I think there are, like, two fronts at which you can kind of take this issue. You can take it to education. You know, you say, okay, there's a certain amount of profits that are being lost, and you need to do X, Y, or Z to, you know, regain those profits, make sure that you're getting paid for the music or the content, just generally content that you create. There's that aspect. But that's kind of a hard fight. It's an upward battle because, you know, you're always going to be fighting a culture of, you know, we need to just focus on the work and whatnot like that. So you have that approach, but then you can also, I think the most effective is kind of building a framework by which it's easy, number one, it's easy to update, to upload this data. Maybe as you create it, you're, you know, including the data. You know, there are interesting ways that you can go about it that way. But just generally building a framework where it's easy to see, you know, the money that's being lost by you not doing something that is extremely simple, because we made it really simple.
And there are practical examples of money being left on the table.
Absolutely.
Just, you know, because I am Mr. Metadata, I went back to go sort of help my bands on my old label reacquaint themselves with mechanical royalties from the streaming services to make sure that everything was there. One of the artists was administrated by an entity who never bothered putting their information into HFA, so they were getting zero from Spotify. That wasn't the artist's fault, that wasn't there, it was the administrative entity that never bothered following up on the paperwork. So there are holes in the system that are based on human error, based on miscommunication, based on the fact that that all of the information that we have does not get trafficked properly, and authenticity is not, you can't derive authenticity of the data that you're getting.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, you are Mr. Metadata, and he really is, and you also obviously care very much about your artists and want to do right by them and make sure they're doing well, and that's commendable, but also kind of unique, unfortunately. So, you know, someone mentioned earlier that, you know, we need to create a way that's easy to do this. Well, how do we do that? Like, when do we create a system when the labels are going to say, okay, now it makes sense for us to go back through and fix all of this metadata from the past 50 years?
Okay, so I would say that the first thing we can do is to fix the system so that new stuff that's coming online has accurate data associated with it. And a lot of work being done at DDEX, and now the RIN, release identification, notification, format, specification, I guess it is. And if we can figure out how to capture that data for newly created works, then the next step will just be start with the low-hanging fruit of your top-selling catalog and go back. And I don't know that we're ever going to get to the long tail.
Right.
Economically, it might not make sense for everybody, but it might very well make sense for Bill's artists to make sure they're registered with Harry Fox's Sound Exchange.
Because they're my friends, it really financially the juice is really not worth the squeeze.
Right.
Yeah, the juice is not worth the squeeze is another topic. We could have a separate panel on that one.
And one thing I was going to mention, if we want to measure the economic impact of bad data, I think you also need to look at conflicts, because you can have the best data in the world, but if three different labels are reporting the exact same track, who do you pay? Right. And also the bad data coming from the services, because maybe on the label side, on the RO side, we could have the best data ever, but if services aren't, right now they're not even required to provide ISRC. So there's money left behind with things that cannot even be matched.
So then what are the steps that we take to even now make sure that, you know, if I'm putting out a release this Friday, that everything I am, you know, putting into the data is the correct format, it is the information that is needed, you know, making sure artists, you know, addresses are correct so Sound Exchange can send them the check, making sure, you know, Sound Exchange probably has 50 different John Smiths in their database, if not more. How do we make sure the correct John Smith gets paid? And, you know, mistakes will always get made, that's the nature of the game, but how do we, starting from this day, because it seems like we've been talking about this for a really long time, and I think Bill has been talking about this for a long time. We've all been talking about this for a really long time, and we haven't ever hit a day where we're like, okay, this is it. Like, today is the day when here's the standard, here's how this works, let's go. Because I think we kind of are talking and talking a lot, but, you know, how do we get to the point where, like, okay, here labels, here everyone, do this.
There's actually too many standards, and people keep inventing more. So there's about 105 metadata standards, last time I checked, and more actually, if you really count. But then the value proposition, I think World Intellectual Property Organization valued the 2016 value of IP in general, not just music, but IP globally at around $4 trillion, but the potential was actually seven plus. Mm. So there's obviously a loss in gains, right? Aside from the actual, what you're actually getting, that's a different discussion. But then there's the normalization to your points, where once you pick a standard, you have to have some kind of template saying, hey, here's a standard that we're gonna follow, here's a standard templated contracts for our smart data, for our smart contracts, for our machine readable metadata, and then normalize it to it. Because when I speak to the people who actually do the metadata, 80% of their time is spent on cleaning it up, literally. Like, so a data scientist is spending 80% of their week cleaning up from Tuesday, literally, through Thursday, is cleaning up, and the rest of the time is actually analysis.
Right. Yeah. So I think Courtney made the comment about foundation and then Luis about conflicts, and we just need to have authoritative sources of disambiguating data. Mr. Jessup in the back calls identity management data. And if we can start with that, we can build a foundation and build on it. I've been saying this on panels for years.
So, like,
hopefully
why
this
haven't
today
we?
Is different.
Yeah, so, like, that's, you know, I mean, we've all been saying this on panels for years. So why have, like, what is the thing that is stopping us?
So I think the point on, like, standards and how we, you know, represent the data, that is definitely a false hope. Kind of to go down that path. You know, we could write it down on paper in any kind of format that we like, and it's still going to be a huge mess trying to keep those pieces of paper in sync. So what is the answer? The answer is definitely, you know, using software that we have created. And so there are two real avenues that I see as, you know, areas of improvement. There's the keeping data in sync, the authoritative database that we can create and share amongst, you know, large parties in this industry, and, you know, many other industries can use that. And then there's the, like, data ingestion problem, where we're ingesting data from people who, you know, may or may not have the real incentives in place to make that data, you know, powerful. So I think on the keeping things in sync, keeping these databases in sync side, I think it's a pretty clear path forward in one sense, in the sense that right now it is very, it takes, 48 hours on the low end to, realize that you have conflicts between one, organization and the other, right? That is a ridiculous amount of time, and normally it's even longer than that. So we need to lower the time that it takes to realize that we have conflicts within our data. And I think that would be a huge first step to keeping these databases in sync.
And that would take transparency.
Yeah, and that would take some degree of transparency, but you could potentially architect it in such a way where you're only sharing specific amounts of data with the people who already have some knowledge of that information. And as long as you trust the person who you're sharing it with, you're able to say, okay, he's not going to just lie and say that he has that data, or he's just making up that data so he can steal what the actual thing is. I mean, maybe there's a case where that would happen, but most of the time that would be okay. And that would go back to kind of, we don't want a central database of, the authoritative thing. We don't need the GRD where we can sink tons of money in. We want, a protocol, a way to keep these databases in sync that is not, a standard. It's, software that keeps it in sync. Blockchain. Sorry.
So what are the challenges to actually making that happen then?
Buy-in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Most of my clients actually have to have significant pain before they actually even bother. And usually the pain that they have to realize for rights management is they have to get sued first, and then they feel the pain. And then they say, oh, maybe we should do something because our lawyers say that we need to do some due diligence so we can, say that we're not that bad anymore.
So all the lawyers in the room, start your engines, I guess?
But in that pain, you don't want to add more things to their queue, realistically speaking. They're already busy enough, last time I checked, especially the in-house counsel. And I speak to a lot of them, they're like, please stop adding more things to my queue and having magic things up here on my desk. And that's partially the transparency and the education to the people within the organization to know that this is a violation, this you can do, or here's the standard, make sure we see all the contracts before you sign and handshake, because you can't have machine-readable handshakes, last time I checked, things like that.
It still goes also back to the juice is worth the squeeze conversation, right?
Yep.
Because record labels and publishers and, these companies were not designed, this industry did not start, in the tech boom. We started, hundreds of years ago with player piano rolls.
Yeah.
So the mentality and the infrastructure and the spirit of a creative entity is very different than a tech-forward, scrum meeting-oriented type organization. So when you think about the people who are rights holders and rights owners, I believe that there are people who are moving the ball forward. Every organization that's up here, the PROs, has, forward-thinking people. Every publisher, or a good portion of publishers have forward-thinking people. Many labels have forward-thinking people. The majors actually all do.
Oh, absolutely.
The problem is allocation of resources and whether or not the sort of what I call the Mount Olympus level decides to dedicate resource to this problem, because nobody gives a shit about the plumbing until the toilet backs up.
Well, and you had a really good point when we were talking about this earlier where...
No pun intended.
where you were saying, you've worked on projects, and I think we all have, where... labels are chaotic places, right? There's a lot of turnover at the top. There's a lot of churn. You could be 90% of the way there with one person at the label, and then, oops, he's gone or she's gone, and the next day there's someone brand new who's like, this is stupid. So, how can we sort of work around the fact that labels are not born of this technological age, sometimes led by people who have no interest in this, and oftentimes chaotic places, and oftentimes under-resourced. How do we start chipping away at those, again, really fundamental problems?
Okay, Courtney, I get a question, kind of a question that you raised before, which was somebody made the comment that people are not, people meaning all the parties involved here, are generally speaking not incentivized to solve the larger problem. So, Luis, in the case of Sound Exchange, if the Pandoras of the world, SiriusXM, are not obliged to report even the ISRC, there's not a strong incentive for them to do it. And there's only two ways to really incentivize people other than litigation, and that is to either pay them more or penalize them. And there's been talk of trying to collectively penalize bad metadata sources in the industry. Not sure how that works, but there's been discussions of it.
Does anyone else on the panel have any thoughts on that? Do you think that's an effective tool?
With respect to pain, so I was on a panel in Estonia, believe it or not, with the head of the CTO of the country. And, you know, there are only 1.5 million people, so it's like White Plains.
I have to say, I was just in Estonia, and it is awesome, and you should all go. Right. It's like this amazing place, very tech-savvy. Anyway, continue.
But he was, based on the discussion that we were having on this panel, he was shocked and chagrined that we could not enforce proper data, because in their country, what they did is, he just said, we enforce through pain. And the pain was, they reinvented their entire education system, and made all the teachers and students get on one database, and basically they said, yes, well, we've invented this new thing, and it's got to be implemented in 2 weeks, and if the teachers, you don't start using it, you don't get paid. Okay, thanks. Magically, they had 100% compliance within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, we here in the United States, and we here, you know, don't necessarily operate in that very similar way, but there are ways. Now, for example, when you look at the physical retail world, back in the days of yore of giant physical music retailers, the UPC code became a requirement. And the UPC code became a requirement because they needed to electronically monitor everything that was going on in the store and scan it. And so if you wanted your release in a Tower or Circle in the Square or whatever any of these, you know, chain stores were, you had to put a UPC on it, and it had to be unique, and it had to be identified. Right? So It was implemented. Now with metadata and with the ISRC, it took a long while to ramp up, and enforcement now in the ISRC is pretty good. On that side. Well, not for you guys.
No, for him. Right. Exactly.
Well, that was different because they acquire their. They don't acquire of the services that report to you. Don't necessarily require. They don't import.
There's not a requirement to provide ISRC.
Right. Right. Standard DSPs.
Right.
That's the.
Right. And some of the DSPs have helped in the case of Apple, for example, and iTunes requires an ISRC when they ingest new tracks. It's not a perfect system, but I can tell you that among other things, I'm responsible for making sure the U.S. ISRC agency works. Actually, Mr. Paul Jessup is responsible for that, but. It is part of my responsibility. And when iTunes did that, surprisingly, the number of people applying for ISRC registrant codes and the number of codes being assigned went through the roof. And
so real quick, what is an ISRC code for the folks in the room who might not be as familiar? And if we can just sort of, you know, we're all sort of acronym people, but I know that not everyone, I mean, this is very, very complicated, crazy stuff. Okay. So
if the previous panel went through any of this stuff, everybody familiar with the ISRC?
Let's just do a quick...
Okay, so it's an ISBN type number. It's not exactly the same for an individual unique sound recording. If anything significant changes in the sound recording, it's assigned a new number, theoretically.
Okay, great. Sorry, so continue. Sorry about that.
So, no, I'm good.
Okay. Okay, so let's back up and talk about, again, why don't they have to submit this to Sound Exchange?
Hey, if the Copyright Royalty Board could change the law so that services are required to provide ISRC, that would be awesome. Because it took a lot of effort to get where we are. We matched 90% or 91% like the minute things come in. But that 9%, it takes a long time to get matched. And it's always because of services providing bad data. So, I mean, the bad data, it's something that we could probably fix on the RO side, on the label side, but if they have people typing in their metadata.
Well, let's give an example. This is a true example. Sound Exchange gets a report from a digital broadcaster, and it says, the song L-O-V-E by N.Cole. Okay, so that narrows it down to the 12 recordings that Nat King Cole made of the song Love that he wrote, and the 3 recordings his daughter made, and the 17 other recordings that Natasha Cole and anybody else who's... And we haven't even touched on the 127 other songs called Love.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's why we need these numbers. And if they reported the number to Luis, suddenly a lot of his pain would.
Right. Well, there's also the problem is that, you know, how many artists do you get named artist name, and how many you like featuring artist name and track one.
Right. No,
yeah. Various artists.
I was going to say to your point that don't worry, the label name is not available.
Well, I've been trying to change my name to Various Artists since 1999. I'm this close.
I think unknown artist might be better.
Artist unknown. Featuring guest. Right. That's why I'm changing my driver's license tomorrow. So it sounds like the blame is really spread around, right? We've got bad data from labels, we've got bad data from the streaming services and the radio stations. We've got, you know, everything's and the systems which we're using to process it are not great.
Right.
So
the other problem is not only is that there's bad data, but the benefits to fixing it, the ROI on that investment. Yep. A lot of people, when they only look at their own, which is logical if you're in a business, their own short-term ROI, in many cases, it's hard to justify. Can you spend tens of millions of dollars to make sure that you get a few million dollars over the next few years? But if everybody did that, the whole system, and I give a presentation about the zip code system in the U.S. in 1963 when the Postal Service implemented the zip code system, they expected to save, you know, like a few billion dollars or something. And then a couple of years ago, they wrote a report that said they believe that the zip code system contributes $1 trillion or something to the U.S. economy. I can't remember what the number was, but it was ridiculously high, hundreds of billions or something. Because everybody from Amazon to FedEx to everybody else is using it. It's used. Nobody imagined how it would be used and who would benefit. And if we fix some of these fundamental data issues, everybody's going to benefit in ways that maybe they can't see yet.
It kind of sounds like, you know, we just need to lower the cost, right? Someone needs to come in with a solution that works, that is not insanely expensive for everyone. So even in the short term, kind of not even looking into the future side of things, they will see, oh, this is actually going to save me this year X amount of dollars, and that already recoups half or more of the cost that I put in. And, you know, next year, 2 years ago, I mean, 2 years later, we'll all be making trillions of dollars.
I mean, there's also a thing where, you know, we don't live in an era anymore. We live in an era of open source software. We live in the era of the cloud. We don't live, you know, anymore in the thing where, you know, it's not a good database unless you spent $20 million on it. You know, people can build incredibly scalable solutions, you know, pretty inexpensively now. And the technologies that can underlie these transactional systems, you know, don't have to cost a lot of money. I mean, and there's a backbone, you know, whether it be, you know, Ethereum or the Bitcoin blockchain, you know, that can help with all of this. You know, again, it's one component, you know, and, you know, it's being worked on. But establishing provenance and persistence with this data is very important. And being able to always track back the rights to an authenticated owner is important. And being able to change those blocks and being able to change those fields in the giant globally distributed spreadsheet that is the blockchain is really an interesting and low cost or lower cost solution to a lot of these problems. So we don't live again in the age where you just have to build these canonical databases anymore.
And there's too many silos too many databases, and they're not connected. So there's no single source of truth within even one organization. Let alone the ones where they're sharing into multiple channels. And then there's the truncation of metadata because certain channels only fit N call because there's only N number of characters allowed to be shown to whatever channel you're listening to. So it could have been Natalie Cole or it could have been someone else, but back to your earlier points.
So how do you even penalize like people for having bad data if there's no established truth on what is the good data, right? So you can't even start to solve the problem until you've kind of established, okay, we now know what we believe is true as an industry, as a human species. IP is a big issue, right? So we need to utilize technologies that are right there in front of us that actually address this very specific problem. You know, it's not going to solve the data ingestion problem. It's not going to solve like a lot of these issues that we're having, but at least the problem of staying in sync, we have a solution that very well could work and probably won't cost, you know, millions and millions of dollars. Actually, definitely will not cost millions and millions of dollars.
So I have a question that I wanted to throw out to the panel because I legitimately don't know this, and I'm curious to see if anyone else does. How do other creative industries handle this? So does the film industry or the book publishing industry or the television industry, for example, do they have similar problems in terms of their digital distribution and rights management? And if so, have they solved them, and how have they solved them?
It's the same as ours, but different. They have the film industry has a great standard called EITR that kind of has been able to get wider implementation and is more normalized. But if you talk to anybody from the DEG, the Digital Entertainment Group, because of the different versions of films, the different languages of films, the different, you know. They have a lot of the issues. What they don't have is the rights conundrum that we do, because a studio is a studio is a studio, and they're the central owner. Whereas with music, you have multiple parties declaring ownership in multiple fractured parts.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more, you know, it's more like the finance industry than it is, you know, a media business in a weird way, because everybody owns multiple parts of a song.
Do you have something you want to?
I'm Ed Claris. We'll be speaking a little later about some of these other industries, but there are a lot of obligations in television and movies. There are participants. It's not a studio is a studio is a studio. There's payments that you're getting, rights in payments that have to be shared through contingent compensation deals with talent, with writers, with all kinds.
Is that internally or externally, though?
It's external. I mean, you might have a third-party production company or a third-party actor who gets a percentage of gross or a percentage of net. There's all kinds of obligations that accrue to every studio and every production company in a very similar way to the music business. It's just music business talks about it a lot more, but there is a lot of that in movies and television.
I mean, I work on audiovisual rights before I joined Sound Exchange, and you basically face, I think, the same problems, but the volume is several orders of magnitude lower because there's not as many movies as there are songs, basically. And it's something that you can throw bodies at it and you can get it fixed, basically. And I think EITR, as you said, there's good standards, ISAN back in the day, Leverage of ISNI, I think somehow they're doing a good job. On the audio industry and the music industry, back to what we were saying, I don't believe it's a technology problem, basically, because today with technology, you can build whatever you want. You can build a database, you can have standards. We have DIDIX, we have ISRC, we have ISWC, we have ISNI. I think, as you were saying, I don't know if there's a lack of understanding of how much money is being left behind on the table, basically.
Well, there's the other problem about not enough juice from the squeeze, or whatever. juice is not worth the squeeze, and that's in the case of the majority of sound recording revenue is now coming from streaming services, and the streaming service pool of money is actually fixed. So it's great if Bill's artists get paid when they hadn't been paid, but it's not growing the pie, and we need to make things efficient across the board so the industries can expand into new business models and to making things easier. And, you know, there's micro-licensing and all kinds of other things, but when it comes back to is the foundation that Courtney mentioned, we have to figure out how to fix the foundation. And
I think part of that fix is the conversations, even internally to organizations, don't happen where the legal people have to talk to the technical people, and they're both guilty, realistically speaking, of overcomplicating things. And in order to reach machine-readable metadata or machine-readable rights, for that matter, they have to come up with, the lawyers will have to come up with the language, and the technical people will have to come up with the machine-readable language that they just mentioned. for the rights, whether it's for movies or any other medium, honestly, because no matter whether it's audio, video, text, graphics, or photos that you're licensing, right? Whether it's for the content creating organization or the licensee, right? They all have these challenges of tracking what are they licensing it for and how are they licensing it, and it's so complex that they can't track it.
And this is going to be more and more of a problem. You know, the film industry may not feel it right now, but, you know, with the number of YouTube videos that are being uploaded and the number of, you know, self-created YouTube stars, it's going to be on the rise. The internet is, it's a content explosion, essentially. So this is going to be a huge issue for all industries.
But we have to remember that, you know, there was a study in the UK about iTunes sales about 4 years ago, and they looked at all the songs on iTunes and .co.uk. 80% of them had never been sold even once in the UK. Because mm-hmm. every garage band from the Florida Keys to Juneau, Alaska have uploaded their stuff. They don't have a grandmother or girlfriend in Manchester. And likewise, the garage band from Newcastle didn't sell a single copy in the US or Australia or New Zealand. Well, actually, he has an aunt in New Zealand. So this very long tail of adding 9 million songs to the download market, it's now shifting the same way in the streaming market.
But I don't know.
If we're worried about collecting money for the business, maybe those songs that are only streamed a handful of times is not going to be our problem. The do-it-yourself UGC stuff. I mean, on YouTube, 29 of the top 30 videos are professionally created music videos from major indies or major labels.
But there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg argument there, and I agree that we're never going to get to 100% with this. That's just not feasible. But because now so much of the streaming, you know, streaming services are so curated and the playlists on the streaming services are so big, and if there's a way to get those acts, you know, I mean, people are looking through the data to find stuff to put on these playlists, and in Spotify's case, their machines are reading the data. So if we can make sure that these artists have a fighting shot,
yeah.
you know, maybe, you know, yeah, maybe it's some garage band, but then maybe they're on the top, you know, Spotify's 10 next big things and they get huge from that. So how do we, you know, how do we sort of make sure the playing field can at least be level for those folks, even if we're going to assume that, yeah, we'll never get to 100%?
Well, they have to realize that the metadata makes it searchable. And
right.
if you can search for it, you can find it. But if you can't find it, you can't buy it.
Yeah.
Right?
Or stream
it's
it.
It's that
yeah.
simple. And all the mediums out there, like even in the photo industry, there are well-known organizations that do it very, really well. Sorry, there's about two. And then there's about 300 that don't do it. And honestly, they sometimes purposely don't do it because it's a spend and they don't bother. So none of their photographs are searchable, for example. And it's sad. And then, of course, the top ones, well, they sell really well because they have a lot of keywords and searchable terms.
So I think we've got about, let me look at my watch, we've got about 10 minutes for questions. So if anyone has any questions, Ned has the microphone.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I'm a 30-year copyright attorney. I'm on the ground dealing with this every day on so many different levels. So thank you for all of your expertise and all of that. Courtney, you had mentioned early motivation. I get 2.5 pages of the definition of a capital D delivery in recording agreements and in music publishing agreements about what information I have to give. But the black box is huge. There's no incentive for them to take that information and use it to start paying my artists and my songwriters and my producers. So there's no motivation there to put the information together. I also once came up with the idea of a scrub company where all of these different rights owners could aggregate their information, have it scrubbed, and put to the copyright office so there was no conflicts. They would save 2/3, like 66.5% of their money for registrations. Nobody was interested. There was no motivation for that type of aggregation and scrubbing whatsoever. And then legislation comes up, like the Orphan Works bill, where you're saying, okay, if we don't have the information and we can't find you, you're not the infringer is not an infringer. So, I mean, the word infringer is in the legislation, mm-hmm. which is just mind-blowing to me. And it's not a question as much as we on the ground, they're starting to get some motivations. I buy and sell catalogs. I need to know who owns what on behalf of the buyer or the seller. I aggregate the different databases. I go to the PROs. I go to the copyright office. I do all of that. It's aggregated at the legal level of the buy and the sell. With copyright terminations now under Section 203 and 304 of the Copyright Act, we have to find who the rights owners are in order to challenge the current owner to get the authors their rights back. So there's pain, there's positive, there's money saving. So it's not a question as much as it's just a comment, and if anybody else has had any similar experiences or any resolutions here, because I have I have three billionaires I represent that are looking to invest in startups that can solve these problems, and they've come and they've failed. They have all failed. So I don't know if anybody else has any experiences or any comments. And I'm sorry, but my mind is just blowing. And with Sound Exchange, I want to just say, we have found several people within Sound Exchange that are scrubbing information for us. I have a producer who has 20 years of recordings that he wasn't put on, and Ricardo within your organization is helping greatly, so thank you.
So I think that just in the interest of time, we do have a networking break after this, so maybe we can all chat about that there, but I'd like to get people, if anyone else has questions, I'd like to give them the opportunity, and then we can chat a little bit more afterwards.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I'm relatively new to the industry, but I'm a data nerd, so this was a great intro to the chaos. Thank you. Question, is there any opportunity that you can see for crowdsourcing some of this data, especially the kind of archive stuff?
I mean, when you look at things, you have already, obviously, things like Music Brains, but none of this stuff is authenticated. So the problem is that what is the source? Is it actually come from a... The problem is always authority, mm-hmm. right? And things like Discogs or Music Brains are helpful if you're creating contextual pieces of information. But as far as authority when it comes to payments or truly disambiguating data for financial transactions or even information that artists may want displayed themselves on a service, you just have to remember that it's like using Wikipedia, so you know it's subject to the whimsy of people, and doesn't come directly from the artist. So there's difficulty in crowdsourcing some of that information.
The sweet spot I think is crowdsource plus reputation, right? If you have a crowdsourced effort, you could crowdsource it between the major PROs, right? Like that's a kind of crowd. It's a pretty small crowd, but like you need that reputation factor. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have the reputation infrastructure right now built, but that is a huge area of interest.
And the crowdsourcers have to have that knowledge in order to say like add the metadata or add this.
Yeah,
language.
If it's a closed network of a bunch of authoritative sources coming together to pool their data to crowdsource and create a more canonical source, sure, that is possible if it comes from authoritative sources.
And if the sourced data have provenance, so you know who claimed they wrote 75% of a song.
Right. Let's do one more question, and then we can.
Usually involves two people.
So when it comes to authority, it seems that at the end of the day, even when you have a dispute, the only real source of authority is going to be a court who does the resolution between a dispute. Where do you see the DMCA takedown process as a source for getting people who want to assert a claim over the correction of who the correct authority is and using that data as a source of authority?
DMCA data as a source
of
authority?
So somebody issues a takedown. They're the ones that are actually making a claim, and whether or not that claim is disputed or not, whether that goes to a court or not, does that person making a claim become an authoritative source?
No, probably not. I mean, if you look at the process of claims and disputes on the label side, when you use the kind of, you know, on the, you can dispute claims, and some kid can upload one of my records to YouTube. Now, I have all my stuff claimed and whatever, so I can automatically claim that stuff through fingerprinting. But if I wanted to do a takedown, that kid could protest and say, well, I bought the CD and I own it. Like, you can say anything. It's fair use. Right. There's any ways that you can claim and dispute.
On both sides.
Right.
You can make a claim.
Right. So it's not necessarily as authoritative. It's kind of he said, she said. There's no official.
I think maybe one case would be if somebody, in this case probably Warner Music or Bruno Mars's publisher, sent like 100,000 takedown notices for Uptown Funk, then you would start to think that maybe this guy actually owns the rights because he's gone to the effort to send 100,000 or a million takedown notices. Is that what you meant?
Well, in a sense, like, so YouTube is getting all these claims, right? And they're getting these lists from the major labels as well, right? So there is a source of people asserting that they are the correct owners of this, right? So building off of all of those claims, as you go through and start to get claims and counterclaims and then eventually court resolutions on when there is disagreement, eventually those records become an authority because the court is really the only one who can make that disambiguation.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily sure because like YouTube obtains canonical sources of information from the labels themselves. They get the information to put into their content ID system from the labels themselves. They've established authority through direct business deals with the content owners who, by nature of their contract, have the authority within their space. So
it's not just the labels, though.
So or publishers or whatever.
So we're actually out of time. So we've got a great break afterwards until I believe 11:15. So there's a lot of great conversations to be continued here. I want to thank the panel again. This has been, I think, really interesting and informative. And thank you all for coming.